right now we have a string to battle a giant.
That's Frankfurt Mayor Chris McBarnes. Driving over a railroad crossing, he says, is frequently blocked by stopped trains. According to a state law, local governments have the authority to fine a railroad company if a crossing is blocked for more than 10 minutes. So McBarnes has begun urging residents to call the police, who've so far written 3 tickets. Problem is, the fines max out at $500 apiece. That's about 1/1,000,000th of the profits CSX made in the fourth quarter of 2017 alone, a financial slap on the wrist. McBarnes says he's just trying to get the railroad's attention.
What we're also calling is we're calling upon our state legislators to put a law, a stiffer law into place with teeth behind it that gives local communities the ability to go to battle with these people if we need to.
There's already a case before the Indiana State Supreme Court concerning blocked crossings. The Norfolk Southern Railway Company argues the existing state statute is preempted by a federal law, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, which centralizes regulation at the federal level. The court has yet to rule on the case. Meanwhile, residents of many Indiana communities must find alternate routes around stopped trains.
I might sit here for another 15 minutes, maybe. If it's still not moving, then I'll go around or just figure out something else to do.
Charles Hart works in Crawfordsville and was on his way to the gas station after work when a train stopped and blocked an intersection along his route. He says he used to be stopped 3 or 4 times a week.
This one doesn't bother me as much because this is a side street, but a lot of times they block down at the, they block 3 highways basically when they stop downtown.
Those stoppages cause traffic to become so congested that Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton set up a camera at the intersection that live streams to his office.
Right now it's pretty calm other than what they're doing on the south side, which is a problem, but it's not the catastrophe that when they block down here. So
the Tippecanoe County Election Board has declined to sanction or even to fully investigate West Lafayette Police Chief Jason Domkowski's admitted illegal use of a city-issued cell phone to make calls about his campaign for county sheriff. In a speedy meeting earlier today, board members dismissed multiple complaints to them about Domkowski's behavior as normal correspondence in an election year and claimed they don't think the electioneering gave the candidate what they called an unfair advantage over his 2 challengers. Here's Board Chairman Randy Vonderhyde.
Biggest concern would be, how does this affect the election, if at all? And I have personally some difficulty seeing that it would affect the election, but that's not my decision to make. I make my decision in the voting booth.
Vonderhyde repeatedly said he thought coverage of the case in the media was enough investigation into Domkowski's acts, which the chief has admitted and for which he has paid the city of West Lafayette some money to cover the monthly cost of his phone bill. After the meeting, Vonderhyde chalked up the acts of West Lafayette's top cop to Domkowski's lack of experience running for office.
Tate says he confronted Elsie, telling her he wanted to alert the city and county to what he saw as deception. He also says she told him he would regret it if he did. Elsie disputes Tate's version of the events.
And I said, is that a threat? She said, no. I said, well, sounds like a threat to me.
I'm not going to comment on that because that's not what was said, but that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to get into a he said, she said.
Elsie has not provided any proof of a change in the relationship between the shelter and the Purdue program, despite repeated requests. So where does that leave the Humane Society?
Good girl. It's a good girl. Yes.
Interim Director Ben Pfeffer walks from cage to cage in a room filled with cats. Pfeffer took over the Humane Society on August 19th, 2 days after Jim Tate was let go.
As you can see, there's a lot of repairs that have to be done to the building. The building's pretty beat up.
Several board members have resigned this year, citing the board's lack of support for Jim Tate and his staff.
The last question I had for them was, with you firing him tomorrow, who is going to feed the animals tomorrow? And they sat there 5 minutes in total silence with deer in the headlight look. So they had no game plan.
And a reluctance to spend money on needed maintenance.
It's not in the budget. It's not in the budget. It's not in the budget. We can't do that right now. We can't do this right now.
Those were former board members Donna Wells and Karen Moskowitz, both of whom say Tate was treated unfairly by the board. But the budget may not have been as lean as board members suggested. Moskowitz confirms what tax documents from 2016 appear to show. that the board likely had about $85,000 in cash it could have allocated to rodent control, fixing a dilapidated building, buying new equipment, or even paying for the spaying and neutering that Purdue would no longer do, if that had actually been an issue.
This is WBAA News. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Clinton County Humane Society Interim Director Ben Pfeffer resigned that post last week. In a press release, Pfeffer attributes his early exit from the position to what he calls micromanagement issues with the board that oversees the shelter. Pfeffer, a former Humane Society board member himself, stepped in to run the shelter after a previous director, Jim Tate, was fired in August. And as WBAA's Emily Seiberg reports, Pfeffer says he now has a better understanding of Tate's issues with the board.
Ben Pfeffer, who'd previously been the treasurer of the Humane Society board, was brought back to lead the shelter 2 days after Jim Tate's August termination. His term was supposed to last at least until Halloween. Instead, it lasted just 50 days.
The board didn't care for my style of management, which was, if I disagreed, I pushed back.
Pfeffer says his ability to run the shelter was sometimes stymied by board members who inserted themselves into the decisions he had to make as director, using their positions as leverage to get involved.
Not all the board members, but the leadership of the board likes to play in the adoption process. They like to play in the operation of how things work in the facility. They are quite good at setting a policy without consulting the director to begin with.
When he says leadership, he mostly means board president Nancy Elsie, though he says what he calls other strong board members also interfered.
This was absolutely exactly what happened when Jim Tate was director, and I am willing to go on record that I apologize to Jim publicly that if I at any time ever overstepped my boundaries as a treasurer, that I was wrong.
I'll be darned. Guess I should have sat down for that one.
That's Tate after he heard Pfeffer's apology.
If I've done anything that's, you know, hurt him or damaged his credibility, I apologize as well. And, maybe we can meet in the middle somewhere here.
You're listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with Stan Jastrzebski. I'm Emily Seiberg, and we're speaking with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. Please call in your questions for the mayor at 496-1999. You can also email ask@wbaa.org or tweet a question at WBAA News on Twitter. Mayor, now let's talk about the ongoing situation with the Clinton County Humane Society. We've been reporting on this, of course, here at WBAA. I'd like to go back to the beginning a bit and talk about the origins of this trap, neuter, release program. It was started because of a feral cat program. People were contacting the Humane Society, contacting the mayor's office to express their concerns about this issue. Can you talk about what groundwork was laid in that first year for how this program would operate?
Absolutely. So, I, as mayor, I get a lot of calls about a lot of different issues. And what seems like a small issue to me is a large issue to someone else. So I try to take all the complaints, all the suggestions to heart. And one thing, I do a monthly radio show here in town. Obviously, people call my office every day. And one consistent complaint I received were feral cat issues. Now, I will tell you, I don't get the calls about the feral cat issues that I once did. I can't remember that I got a call about a feral cat issue. So based upon that, because people do call me if there are problems, I would have to say that the situation has been bettered.
Mayor, I'm so sorry. Were other TNR programs researched? Do you have any sense of were we looking to other programs and saying these are best practices that we can abide by as we're setting this up? And I'm kind of asking this because it doesn't feel like perhaps best practices have been maintained since, if that makes sense.
Well, in terms of the TNR, it was brought to our attention at the time. It wasn't a brainchild, I believe, of the Humane Society. This was something that was done in other areas. And if you look at how to control that population, it makes sense. You live trap a cat, you spay or neuter it, you put that cat back in that area so other cats don't come in and create dominance over that area. I mean, it made sense. And And I can say it again, it's worked. Now, what has fallen apart over the past several weeks has been the lack of transparency and the lack of accountability, which is a shame because, again, I believe the program was effective. I can say that. If it would not have been effective, citizens would have continued to call and say, hey, Chris, we still have this problem in our neighborhood. You need to do something different. But it was meeting a need that I was hearing at the time.
You said you ballparked $10,000 and then $20,000. And talking about the transparency and talking about trying to figure out how all of these numbers came to be, what we'd like to talk a little bit about, and I suspect you would too, is the idea of documentation, how to figure out what costs what, where the dollars are being spent. Emily did a story recently where she talked to the current board president, Nancy Elsey, whose explanation to us was, well, can you say where every penny is going at the county highway department? And our supposition was, well, probably there's an accounting process in place somewhere, right? But at the same time, we don't actually know what those accounting practices are. Can you shed some light on how each penny is maintained in each line item?
Absolutely. If you ask me where money has gone in my street department, I could provide you a broken down itemized list today. And that's any department citywide. And when you're dealing with taxpayers' money, and let's keep in mind here, you know, the city provides $20,000 for TNR. Clinton County government, the county taxpayers, provide close to $100,000 for daily operations here. And then you have donors that are giving their hard-earned money. You're a 501c3. You should have accounting practices in place to be accountable for how those dollars are being spent. Could I do that for every department in the city? Absolutely. And I can't speak for the county highway department, but I'm guessing that Kevin Myers could do the same thing.
Bells chimed from the Montgomery County Courthouse clock tower Sunday for the first time since World War II. Residents braved scorching heat and lined the streets of Crawfordsville to see its dedication. The first tower was taken down in the 1940s after a painter discovered it was leaning toward the street. Its bell was melted down to make ammunition for the war effort. Clock Tower Committee President Sandy Laughlin Brown spearheaded the movement to replace the tower. She says it was largely a grassroots movement as they didn't receive any giant donations.
When we talked to people, a lot of times early on they said, you're never going to do that. That's a pipe dream. And I said, no, that is not a pipe dream. We are going to do it. So the best word I can say is I feel fulfilled.
Laughlin Brown says the man after whom the tower is named, local Dr. James Marion Kirtley, was like a father to her. The late doctor and World War II veteran's dying wish was that the tower be rebuilt. His son, David Kirtley, was emotional during the ceremony. He says he's sure his father was smiling down proudly at the dedication.
He'd say he was elated, he was proud, and God bless it.
This is WBAA News. I'm Emily Seiberg. As WBAA set up its mini-golf conversations about this year's local elections, every single candidate responded in some way. Unfortunately, not everyone chose to participate. The sheriff's candidates, for instance, got together after their one formal debate and decided they'd forego golfing. Both clerk candidates initially questioned the format, and as WBAA's Stan Jastrzebski reports, in the third and final part of our pre-election series, only one of them could be persuaded to putter around the course.
The first emails back from both clerk candidates, Democrat Vicky Wiestee and Republican Julie Rausch, questioned the conversation's unorthodox format, which is understandable. It's not been done before, and we were not suggesting a formal debate. Wiestee eventually agreed to participate, but Rausch declined, saying she'd prefer, in her words, quote, a more professional meeting. That posed a couple of questions. Does WBAA decline to do a story on the race if just one candidate wants to wield a putter? Or do we golf with some candidates and not with others? In the end, we elected to stick with the format we'd advertised. We decided canceling the talk would give an unfair advantage to any candidate who declined to speak, since they'd effectively be silencing their opponent, too. So we spent a recent Saturday morning on the course with Wiestee.
Diggity.
Who carded a 4-over par round, which was good for a tie for the best election mini-golf score of the season, along with the round shot by Senate candidate Sherry Shipley. But it's the answers to the questions that make the candidate, not their golfing acumen. Wiesty, who's worked for the American Bar Federation since 1994, says she thinks the office is being left in good shape by outgoing Republican clerk Krista Coffey, but says Coffey's replacement will quickly be faced with a big task, replacing the county's outdated voting machines.
You know, we're not going to test anything new. We're not going to be a prototype. We're not going to, you know, spend money on something that isn't proven. So I really don't think this is, you know, sort of a pearl-clutching moment for the government. We're ready to do this. Everybody knows it needs to be done.
And in an age where foreign agents have shown an interest in influencing U.S. elections, Wiesty says she's concerned only a couple Indiana counties currently require paper ballot backups.
That will give us a paper trail, paper ballots, auditable trail, and make it much more possible for people to know that their votes were counted as they were cast.
Oh, God, put your hands up. Do it now.
It's over here. Hurry. Oh.
Volunteers lined the hallways of the Tippecanoe County building, acting as wounded victims, hostages, or shooters. Sergeant Leonard Halishak says the training helps police prepare for worst-case scenarios by making faster judgments. Like in one exercise, when the shooter throws a fake explosive device, forcing officers to choose to either run through or hold back. Sean Collins, a volunteer from Lafayette, hoped to do his part to make the scenarios as hard as possible and to point out areas where officers may need to improve.
I told you about how we had a SEM gun sitting on the table in the apartment fight. 90% of them didn't see it because they were focused on the two guys fighting.
Halishak says limited manpower requires lots of planning time, which makes it rare to have more than one training in a year.
Markle, who's also been married before, resonates for Kate Surik.
I am married and I have been divorced, and she gives hope to all of us.
So, how long do the friends plan on staying? Emily Rogers Klein doesn't hesitate.
As long as we're going to continue the service, Momo says.
For WBAA News, I'm Emily Seiberg.
If there was another way, I'd take it. If there was another way down, I'd go.
In 2014, three Grammy Award-winning musicians joined forces to create the female folk trio, I'm With Her. The band's name may conjure memories of the 2016 presidential election, but band member Sarah Watkins says it sprang from an event that predates Hillary Clinton's campaign, which more famously used the phrase for posters and bumper stickers. Watkins says she doesn't think people have trouble separating the two.
I don't know how much confusion there is about that. I don't know that there is a ton of confusion. We named our band in 2015, I think. It started because we named our tour I'm With Her, and it just felt like it reflected our attitudes at the time, which is, you know, a lot of camaraderie and just happiness to be in a band together. And after we did that tour, it just seemed like we started to identify as I'm With Her, and so we just kept it.
Tell it to me, spit it out. If you push me, I'll just get up. Tell it to me.
Released earlier this year, the group's debut album, See You Around, features 12 songs, all but one co-written by the three band members, Watkins, Sarah DeRose, and Aoife O'Donovan. Watkins says rather than playing their songs in a certain order every night, the group tries to take a fresh approach each time they play.
We try a new set list every night, and or most nights, and we don't really play any songs we don't like.
Still, the group stands out as much for its musicality as for who's in the band. Watkins says it's still not uncommon for them to be the only all-female act on a bluegrass concert stage, but she believes a cultural shift has started, however slowly, in their corner of the industry.
Yeah, it seems like there are a lot more women than there used to be, which is great. When I was growing up, I was not terribly aware of the lack of diversity, but I became more aware of it. And now there are a lot more women that you see in the community. I think festivals still need to represent the scope that is out there.
All of the families participate in the free and reduced price lunch program during the school year, and most receive SNAP benefits. But many say they've never participated in a summer feeding program before now. The pilot has been a learning process. On the first day of the program, nobody home at the first stop. The initial goal was 30 participating families, but only 11 are participating. The Tippecanoe County Health Department had worries about whether families would handle food safely. A spokesperson says the department initially thought the home sites would be open to the public in the same sense as congregate feeding sites. Issues health department and food finders officials say were discussed and resolved. According to a report from the Food Research and Action Center, Indiana's existing summer food service program actually saw a 16% increase in participation in 2017, one of three states to see an increase of better than 10%. Indiana served more than 1.8 million lunches last summer at almost 1,400 sites. The departments of education in California, Vermont, and Colorado are fully or partially reimbursing the sponsor organizations for the pilots, but Indiana's is not. Indiana DOE spokesman Adam Baker claims that's because Share Our Strength didn't communicate with state officials in time.
We're clearly opening to discussing that and, you know, knowing more about it and, you know, if there's an opportunity to be involved in it. Absolutely. I mean, there's no competition. I would say the only competition in the hunger game is us and hunger.
At Shadeland Mobile Home Park in Lafayette, Yvonne Cornell is preparing to feed seven children lunch, her own and kids from across the neighborhood. Cornell's daughter Elizabeth snuggles under her mom's arm. Cornell says children often ask her for something to eat, so she tries to stretch the food she has on hand. When Cornell learned about the pilot, she saw it as a simple way to solve the problem of feeding hungry kids at home for the summer. Cornell starts handing out lunch. The kids fill both benches of a picnic table in the front yard, unwrapping cheese sticks and comparing apples and bananas. In 2017, Food Finders served almost 20,000 lunches to an average of more than 300 children per day through the traditional summer feeding program. The pilot program will serve about 1,100 meals to a little over four dozen children. But it's a pilot, and whether the program continues next summer, the children at the picnic table are being fed today. For WBAA News, I'm Emily Seiberg.
From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you listening to the show this month on your Indiana Public Broadcasting station. If you have a question you would like to get on this program, feel free to email it at any time to ask@wbaa.org. And you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Wanted to talk about the editorial you wrote in the Washington Post recently saying that you think that some laws mandating different types of government transparency have run amok a little bit. You speak not very kindly about open records and open meetings laws, and you say they're rendering government, and I'm quoting now, less nimble, less talented, and less effective. Let me pose perhaps the opposite side to you. Is it possible that one of the problems is that government and maybe even public education, which like Purdue and IU and Ball State are part of state government, have gone on in some way in secret and have become used to that way of operation, and so they don't like the idea of change?
I think they were, and it was a great thing. You know, the article was very plain, and I predicted people would overreact and would misrepresent and distort what I said, and they did. You know, this is a very modest proposal. I tried to establish my credentials. A big supporter of these things. I've teamed with Ralph Nader, of all people, to make, for instance, government contracting at both the federal and the state level more transparent. Here and there, a little more leeway would make sense. I'm just saying there's a downside. It's not all positive.
You mentioned people overreacting, and when I saw the responses, and I saw and I read your editorial, it made me think about the scene from Blazing Saddles where Harvey Korman stands up and he says he wants to stomp out runaway decency in the West. And it seems that there is some feeling of that. So one of the responses came from Jerry Lanozga, who's an award-winning investigative journalist. He was writing in the Indianapolis Business Journal, and he says, I'm quoting him now, he says, Daniels hints that giving public officials greater latitude to have private conversations will allow frank discussions that lead to better public policy, but it is at least as likely to lead to questionable deals and corrupt activities, he says. And I got to thinking about some of the criticism you've taken here. The head of the West Lafayette Redevelopment Commission said there was too much secrecy at the outset of the State Street project. That was one local official who said something like that. There were people who wrote editorials saying that when Purdue Global was established as a public benefit corporation, that that didn't allow enough transparency. And so I think those are all sorts of what Jerry's getting at there.
I know what he's getting at, but he's never delivered a single result, you know, in the public interest or in a public capacity. And so it just looks a little different from, I guess, the receiving end than it does from his vantage point. And once again, and it couldn't be more plain if you actually read the article as opposed to what some people wrote about it, that I'm a big supporter of the basic framework. But in some cases, I think it might have been carried one step further than it needs to. There are costs associated with it. And I knew what I was getting into touching this most sacred of cows. But I thought maybe some provoke a little bit of thought that otherwise wouldn't happen. I think it did.
I think that is certainly the case. One last response I wanted to put to you was from the South Bend Tribune's editorial board, who said, further, who gets to decide what is too much transparency and exactly how do you make that determination? And once you begin pulling back on reforms that protect and support the public's right to know, they say, where do you stop? Where does it end? So they're getting at the whole slippery slope argument. And you point out at the very beginning of your argument what Dave Eggers talks about in his novel, where he's talking about public officials who want to be super, super transparent. And that's one dystopian way of looking at it. But it seems to me the other side is you run toward the other side where you don't have nearly enough. You don't even have the reforms that you were talking about a moment ago.
I gave two examples, which to me are very persuasive, of places where very good and necessary reforms went too far. In civil service, thank goodness we reformed a long time ago the old patronage system. It got to the point, however, where it's almost a joke. The federal government can't get rid of anybody, no matter for non-performance. The very worst performers linger on the federal payroll forever, and it's gone a step too far. Procurement's another example. With the very best of motives and very necessary, We started limiting the ability of people to buy things with the public money without being absolutely sure that it was done in a very competitive way. And if you actually go try to do these things these days, at least in certain sectors, they can't buy anything quickly. It costs winds up costing the taxpayer more than it saves and so forth. So it's not as though one can never, ever, ever modify slightly what was a very good idea and preserve the essence of it, but also just deal with the practicalities that anything taken to its complete extreme, I think I said in there, there is a fatal dosage to water if you drink too much of it.
When the Lafayette Farmers Market opens tomorrow morning, it won't be accepting food stamps in exchange for produce. As WBA's Emily Seiberg reports, the market, run by Greater Lafayette Commerce, has been authorized to accept those benefits since February 2016. But 2 years later, the program has yet to begin.
On Saturday mornings between May and October, a crowd converges on downtown Lafayette to visit the Lafayette Farmers Market. Though it doesn't take them yet, it's one of 75 markets in Indiana officially authorized to accept benefits from the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP.
We're hopeful for June as soon as we can, but I'm not going to – no date in place yet.
That's Emily Colombo. She's the office manager and farmers market liaison for Greater Lafayette Commerce. Colombo's farmers market responsibilities were started in 2017. a year after the market had been authorized to accept SNAP.
We were approved, but we didn't have everything else in place, and the pieces just didn't fall for us to be able to start the program.
Taking SNAP requires a machine to run the debit cards beneficiaries use, a machine GLC has had since last summer. It also takes tokens to give to users, which GLC has. So why has the process taken more than 2 years?
Time, for one. I mean, I'm only one person, me, myself. We didn't have a market master last year, so it was tough just to be able to physically have the time to do all of it. We don't have a lot of volunteers with the Lafayette Market, so it's just me trying to put the pieces together.
The process was extremely simple. I got online. There was a form to fill out. I filled out the form, submitted it.
Adrian Akers is the market master for the Kokomo Farmers Market and is one of several people interviewed for this story who say the implementation process took their market nowhere near 2 years. And in that time, Tippecanoe County social service agencies who work with low-income, food-insecure populations using SNAP have been asking for action. Last April, a survey asked clients at several agencies to gauge their interest in using their SNAP benefits at the farmers market. 84% of those surveyed said they would attend the market more often if SNAP was accepted.
I feel like that's a real black and white question. Are low-income people receiving fresh fruit and vegetables part of your mission? Yes or no? Not maybe, or we'd like it to be, or anything else.
A few days later, at West Lafayette's end-of-season market, coordinator Julia Zuchkov stands at a round, umbrella-topped table, teaching volunteer Annette Britton how to operate the brand new machine that allows SNAP users to run their electronic benefit transfer, or EBT, cards and receive the wooden tokens they'll offer vendors for their goods.
You'll give them 5 tokens.
Okay.
So
they've got their card.
So now, do they give us?
While this was the first day SNAP benefits could be redeemed at the West Lafayette Market in 2018, it was also the last until next year. West Lafayette only started the process of applying to offer SNAP benefits at the market this summer, after WBAA had begun reporting on the fact neither local market allowed visitors to use SNAP. West Lafayette faces the same challenge Lafayette does: how to get SNAP users to the market. Zuchkov is also depending on word of mouth.
It was a lot of just talking to people and sort of letting people know that it was going on, but most of it I'm hoping to hit harder next season.
There were no SNAP transactions at the West Lafayette market that day. How many both markets record next year will depend largely on how well they advertise and accessorize.
It's 7:04. Good morning. For WBAA News, I'm Stan Jastrzebski. The annual point-in-time homelessness count is today, and crews nationwide are trying to determine how many people don't have reliable access to shelter. Greater Lafayette's count is a little different than some, and WBAA's Emily Seiberg has been out with the counters this morning. She's live in downtown Lafayette with more. Emily?
And across Indiana today, the point-in-time count is happening. So again, that's a federally mandated count of the homeless population in a given area. Volunteers head out to find and survey sheltered and unsheltered homeless members in their community. That's what they call a snapshot. And the most important question is, where did you sleep last night? And the data from the event helps track homelessness locally and nationally. So we started our morning here at Pete's Diner in downtown Lafayette, headed over to the garden at St. John's and talked with a woman who'd been sleeping outside for the past several nights. And for the past hour, we have been at Lafayette Urban Ministry catching people as they come out of that shelter. But it's about more than collecting numbers here in Lafayette. It's really worked on as an opportunity for outreach. People are given food bags, bags of small essentials. They're sent to a designated space where they can get a hot meal, talk to a caseworker, and get connected to services, even get a haircut. They're hoping to build connections here that last past this one day, this one point in time. Live from downtown Lafayette, I'm Emily Seiberg with WBAA News.
And days after West Lafayette's Unitarian Universalist Church was vandalized with posters bearing threatening language, the community gathered last evening to show unity. As WBAA's Charlotte Tuggle reports, many say it's just the first step to prevent such threats in the future.
Government officials condemned those responsible for the racist and homophobic language by calling it cowardly behavior and an act of attention seeking,
Religious leaders praised the community, and some spoke of the familiarity of the type of attack. Still, Christopher Hagerty, who's on the board of directors for the local activist group Greater Lafayette Indivisible, says he recognizes that hate speech has a pattern of showing up in Greater Lafayette.
A lot of people were saying, this isn't the community we know, but for a lot of people of color and gay people, this is the community that we know. This is, you know, something that we've seen quite a bit.
Hagerty says more marginalized groups should be given a louder voice in the conversations the city needs to be having, ones about racism, sexism, and homophobia. Lafayette resident Lori Morris says if she were face-to-face with whoever posted the sign, have a conversation is exactly what she'd do.
We don't have to love each other 100%, but we certainly do have to live in a civilized society, and this is heading in the wrong direction for that.
Other action items discussed, including passing the proposed bias crimes bill now before the Indiana General Assembly, and the importance of voting, all proposed as tangible ways threats like the one posted outside the church Sunday could be fought. At the end of the event, church officials asked that everyone sign a new banner to be posted outside, adorned with words of equality and hope. For WBAA News, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
In sports news, the Purdue women's basketball team fell last evening 75-61 to Nebraska. Andreana Keys had 14 points in the loss. The men's basketball team, ranked third in the country, plays number 25 Michigan at home this evening at 7 o'clock at Mackey Arena. In weather, mostly sunny skies today, a high expected in the middle 40s. Clear skies tonight with a low in the mid 30s. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high in the mid 50s. Tomorrow evening, a 50% chance of showers with a low in the lower 40s. Then a slight chance of rain Saturday with a high in the low 50s. For WBAA News, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.